On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
The shootings in Orlando have once again put the Second Amendment front and center in our public debate. Does the Second Amendment guarantee everyone's right to own a gun? If so, what kind? What did the framers intend when they wrote that language? Here to help us understand some of the history of the Second Amendment is constitutional law professor and dean of the UC Irvine Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky. Welcome back to the show.
A pleasure to talk with you, as always.
Great to have you. Well, constitutional law professors and historians argue, and we're not going to settle this dispute now, about what it actually says. But what do the different sides of the debate say that the framers intended when they wrote it?
One side says that the Second Amendment means what it says, the right of people to have guns for militia service. And in fact, from 1791 to 2008, every Supreme Court case, and there weren't that many, said that the Second Amendment is just about a right to have guns for the sake of militia service. The other side of the debate says, no, the Second Amendment is about a right to individuals to have guns, even if not for militia service. And in 2008, the Supreme Court said that the Second Amendment's right of individuals to have guns, at least in their home, for the sake of security.
But don't people actually debate these few words and where the commas are placed? It does say a well-regulated militia, but it also says the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Isn't that the debate, whether it's the right of the people or it's for a well-regulated militia?
That's exactly what the debate is about. Those who take the so-called individual rights perspective say that it's the latter half of the Second Amendment that's the so-called operative clause. This is about a right of people to keep and bear arms. Those who take the other perspective say, no, this is a unique amendment in that it states its purpose right in its text. That's a right to have guns for the sake of militia service. And each side points to things that would support it from the framers. Those who take the view that it's guns only for militia service say James Madison drafted the Second Amendment. In an early draft, it also had an exception to militia service for conscientious objectors. They say, see, this is really about a right to have guns just for militia service. The other side says, no, at the time the Constitution was written, state constitutions gave people an individual right to have guns. That's what the Second Amendment was about.
Was this controversial at the time when it was drafted?
Well, remember, the Constitution as drafted had no individual liberties or almost no individual liberties within it. Many states ratified the Constitution on the condition that a Bill of Rights be added.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we got the first 10 amendments. And the Second Amendment was one of those that was ratified. The kind of debate that we're having today over what does it mean just wasn't present then. Maybe they assumed that it was about a right to have guns for militia service. Maybe they assumed it was a right of individuals to have guns in their homes, but it just wasn't focused on in the way we're debating the issue today.
Okay, so fast forward to 1991, and in an interview, retired Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger, hardly a liberal, he said the Second Amendment, quote, has been the subject of one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat, the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime. What was he talking about?
Well, Warren Burger believed that the Second Amendment was a right to have guns solely for the sake of militia service. And he believed that the National Rifle Association and other special interests were pulling a hoax on the American people by saying that it's a right of individuals to have guns for their own use. interestingly, the very position that Warren Berger ridiculed was accepted by a majority of the Supreme Court, albeit in a 5-4 decision, in 2008.
This is the Heller case. Tell us about that case and how it became a landmark case.
Sure. It involved a 32-year-old District of Columbia ordinance that prohibited private ownership and possession of handguns. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, declared the law unconstitutional. Justice Scalia wrote for the court, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito. Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer dissented. I emphasize that because now that Justice Scalia is gone from the court, there may no longer be a fifth justice who takes that position. And if he's replaced by a justice who views that the Second Amendment is just about a right to have guns for militia service, Heller may be overruled, and it certainly won't be extended.
Was that the first time that the court explicitly said what the Second Amendment says and what it means?
Not only was it the first time the Supreme Court ever said that the Second Amendment is about a right to have guns for personal service as opposed to militia service, it was the first time in American history that any law, federal, state, or local, was ever found to violate the Second Amendment. From 1791, when the Second was adopted, until Heller in June 2008, the Supreme Court had always said the Second Amendment is just about a right to have guns for militia service.
The Ninth Circuit recently decided that the Constitution does not guarantee a right to carry a concealed weapon in public. How does that square with Heller?
In fact, I think it's quite consistent with Heller. All Heller said was that people have a right to have a gun in their homes for the sake of security. And Justice Scalia's majority opinion said that there's nothing in this opinion that would keep long-standing gun laws from staying in place. And one of the examples that Justice Scalia gave of the kind of long-standing law to be allowed is a prohibition of concealed weapons. In fact, in the 1890s, the Supreme Court upheld a law that prohibited having concealed weapons. And so the Ninth Circuit saying California can limit concealed weapons to those who get a permit is completely consistent with Heller and the longer history of the Second Amendment.
So short of taking guns out of people's homes, there is a lot of latitude in terms of what lawmakers can do to restrict guns in America.
Well, that's all the Supreme Court has said to this point, is that people have a right to have guns in their homes for the sake of security. What other kinds of regulations there can be are something that's very much being litigated in the lower courts and we're waiting for Supreme Court clarification. Now, in Heller, Justice Scalia said, the government can still regulate who has guns, keeping people with a criminal conviction or a history of serious mental illness with guns. The government can regulate where guns are located and gave the examples of prohibiting guns near schools and airports. And he said the government can regulate what types of guns they have, like keeping people filming bazookas or assault weapons. But what other kinds of regulations would be allowed, that's what's being litigated right now.
Is there a case working its way up through the courts that would challenge Heller?
Well, there are many cases in the lower courts with regard to the Second Amendment. What's interesting is that Heller was now 8 years ago, and in every instance where the Supreme Court has had the occasion of taking a Second Amendment case, with one exception, the Supreme Court has denied review. The only case the court has taken was one decided in 2010, McDonald versus City of Chicago, where the Supreme Court said the Second Amendment applies to limit what state and local governments can do. But I think it's really interesting that for 8 years, almost without exception, the Supreme Court has denied review in every Second Amendment case. But there's plenty more that can get to the Supreme Court.
Erwin Chemerinsky, constitutional law professor and dean of the law school at UC Irvine, thanks for joining us.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think the Second Amendment guarantees the right of every American to own a gun? Do you agree with the Heller decision? What would you like to see done about gun rights and gun violence? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Or you can reach out on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. There have been at least 180 shootings since the Orlando massacre on Sunday. Five of those shootings are considered mass shootings, and that's when at least three people are shot in a single incident. One of those mass shootings was right here in California on Tuesday. A gunman opened fire on a vigil for two drowning victims. A 17-year-old girl was killed in that shooting, and three other people were injured. As we take a closer look at gun violence and how to prevent it, we want to know about the killings that don't captivate the entire nation. And joining us now is Jonathan Metzl. He's the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Metzl, welcome to Press Play.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
So more than 180 shootings, 71 people were killed. That's really less than 4 days because Thursday is not over yet. Is that par for the course?
Well, sadly, it is. We have about 35 to 36,000 gun deaths a year in the United States. And so if you just divide that up by 365 days of the year, we really have a very huge everyday problem with gun violence. The research that I do looks at what happens and what we do in the aftermath of mass shootings. And even though it's understandable that we're having debates right now, mass shootings represent moments of trauma. We ask ourselves the question, how can we stop this unspeakable violence from happening again? But the issues that we debate in the aftermath of mass shootings are issues that will try at least to prevent the next mass shooting. And so it's, should we stop guns from people on the terrorism watch list? Should we have psychiatrists pick which mental ill people might be violent? And even though those are important questions to ask, those really are directed at the spectacular kind of shooting that we see. But beneath that, there's everyday violence, everyday gun violence. And in a way, the measures that I just talked about are less effective at dealing with everyday violence. And I think the tragedy here is that everyday violence, unlike mass shootings, is very predictable, and it's much more preventable than we've let on.
Yeah, the American Medical Association has now called it a public health crisis.
Right. I mean, now more people are dying from gun death in this country than are dying from motor vehicle accidents. I think any other condition in which over 35,000 people were dying would be something that would gain at least our attention in a particular way. The unfortunate part of this is that even calling this a public health issue has been very contested, and organizations like the NRA have really resisted that kind of language because if something is a public health issue, then what you do from a public health framework is you study it. Unfortunately, we've got congressional bans on using federal funding for studying gun violence. And so if they called it a public health emergency, they'd have to lift that ban. It's really an unconscionable, I think, state of affairs.
What would follow after that, after the study? What kinds of things would be deployed in a public health crisis?
Well, you know, there are, in other words, I think there are two layers to this. There's prediction. Can we predict gun violence and can we prevent it? And I think that if we use a prevention frame, I think even now there is a lot we already know about how to prevent, particularly everyday gun violence. So I think having some kind of universal background checks, closing loopholes about having people, you know, it's way too easy for people to get even semi-automatic weapons through the internet and gun shows. So closing those loopholes, smart gun technology, looking at people who have had history, particularly of partner violence. Unlike mass shootings, actually about 85% of everyday shootings occur between people who already know each other. Looking really at social networks, I think, is very important. And then we also have a huge problem with gun suicide. Access to firearms. And I guess the last one would be safety checks, because we have a lot of accidental shootings, so how people store their guns. None of these issues impinge on what you were talking about with the last guest, the Second Amendment. These are really issues about how we sell guns, how we store guns, and kind of those patterns. But I do think that research is very, very badly needed.
Out of those 35 to 36,000 deaths a year you mentioned, how many of those are homicides?
I think roughly, and again, these averages change, but about 18 to 19,000 are suicides. So that's kind of the unspoken understory of this. And then the rest are homicides and different kinds of shootings. You mentioned mass shootings, and those are certainly on the rise as well. But again, the surprising part about this is that as tragic and as horrible as mass shootings like what happened in Orlando are, they really are the statistical outliers about how people really die of gun death. You're much more likely to be shot by your neighbor, your spouse, your, you know, somebody you know, that kind of issue. Gun violence really happens in social networks. And again, 19,000 gun suicides, that's really an issue of access. So the more, you know, the easier it is to get guns, the higher that rate of gun suicide is as well.
Is it actually a disservice when we talk about measures to prevent mass shootings to what you're talking about? In other words, we're not talking about these solutions. Well, we are right now in this conversation, but in terms of legislation, we don't hear politicians calling for legislative solutions for this. As you say, we're talking about, you know, a no-buy list and things like that. Is it actually a disservice to talk about trying to address mass shootings versus everyday shootings?
Well, I certainly think we should try to stop mass shootings. And so in calling it a disservice, I mean, I'm glad that we're, I'm glad we're doing something right now. But I would say that, again, you know, I think that we really need to keep the story going. And so mass shootings are a time when everybody's paying attention to this issue. And then it kind of tapers off. And really the everyday, the kind of toll of everyday violence is almost a local story. But many, so many people have been touched by that, and it's really those stories that I think we need to keep telling. I really think we need to keep telling. And the other part is, very unfortunately, it's just hard to predict. I mean, we want psychiatrists, for example, to predict which one of their, you know, mentally ill patients are going to go commit a violent act, but it's almost impossible for them to do so statistically. Most persons with mental illness are not violent. Same thing with even people on the terrorism watch list, as we saw here in Orlando. And so in a way, we certainly should put common sense measures in place, but I do think that trying to stop everyday gun violence by making it harder for people to amass arsenals, for example, I think that that will also have an impact on stemming the tide of mass shootings as well.
Okay, so if these are local problems, should they have local solutions?
Yes and no. Part of the issue, I think, is that we have a kind of patchwork approach. And so even in areas where we have the best possible gun control that we can imagine, take Chicago, for example, or California, it's very easy for people to get weapons in other ways who really want them. And so in a way, in the absence of a national uniform policy, which is, I think, what we really need, it's too easy to circumvent even the most well-intentioned local ordinances about guns. And so, for example, if you're in Chicago, where, you know, ostensibly it's very difficult to get a gun, you can just drive to a superstellar gun store in Wisconsin or in Indiana. And so it's very hard to police that when the laws are so non-uniform.
Jonathan Metzl is the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Metzl, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the Orlando shooter, Omar Mateen, checked social media to see if he had made the news during the rampage. Shani Jordan is here to talk about that and other web news next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The horror in Orlando is still reverberating, and part of the story is the killer's search and postings on Facebook. We're going to talk about that and more news of the web with Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
So Omar Mateen, he actually checked his Facebook during the attack to see if he was trending.
What a bizarre and chilling detail in a sea of bizarre and chilling details involving technology in this story. So like many other insane murderers, this guy seems very self-obsessed. And as he prepared to gun down scores of innocent people inside the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, we now know that he, on his phone, was checking keywords to see if news of his attack had made him famous yet. He had this these kind of delusions of grandiosity, and that his alignment with ISIS seems to have been kind of This is me talking here, mm-hmm. but it seems like aligning yourself with something much bigger and more powerful than yourself as a crazy lone wacko, rather than the other way around, rather than him being someone that ISIS was, you know, directing to carry out attacks. Yeah, and also the stories that we heard just in the days after about, you know, that horrible tale of the one young victim who texted his mom, and his mom was texting back and forth. You know, to me, it's such a sad and interesting story. You have people who are on the business end of his semi-automatic rifle using mobile technology, which everybody carries around in their pockets now, to try to make one last contact with their family. And in some cases, these were the last words that they would communicate.
And the fact that we are privy to them, too, how do you feel about that?
Really conflicted. You know, it feels like hearing the details of how somebody lost their mom or their dad or their son or their daughter, and knowing so much intimate and personal information. It's just like it hurts to hear these stories.
Yeah.
And in terms of what we know about Omar Mateen and this bizarre vanity searches that he was doing while he was carrying out one of the largest mass murders in American history, I feel like social media, you know, in my lifetime, has made it possible for individuals to transmit a message much more broadly, much more powerfully than we could have a generation or two ago, right? So now I can be as powerful as CNN or MSNBC or KCRW if I have, you know, the right phrase and the right number of followers at the right time. I can have a very big voice as an individual. The same goes for that crazy man with a gun. So he wanted to be legendary.
He wanted
the whole,
as many of these mass murderers, you know, mass shooters want.
And they used to send handwritten letters.
Yeah.
And now they send Facebook posts. Or in the case in Paris, where the terrorist attacked and stabbed a member of law enforcement and his partner, this horrible story, he streamed it on Facebook Live. And as awful as this is, I feel like it's just this really grotesque coming of age for social media. It's just media.
Okay, let's talk about this other strange story that happened on the web this week. And this was the hack, apparently, by Russians of the DNC.
Or not.
Or not. Who knows? It's all so bizarre.
The twist that came out today is fascinating. Yeah, so originally this like internet security forensics company that was working for the Democratic National Committee came out with an announcement earlier this week that Russian hackers had penetrated the Democratic National Committee's servers and released opposition research on Donald Trump, a list of donors, and even some emails from Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State. Something definitely smells fishy about that choice of documents to be leaked. And it's really impossible to say with authority who is responsible for the hack unless you have your hands on forensic evidence, which it doesn't sound like they did. So today, Ars Technica, my colleague Cory Doctorow, and Boing Boing, and a number of other security journalists wrote that this guy calling himself Guccifer 2.0 took credit for the attack. And Guccifer is the name, the handle of a guy who was like a taxi driver who's now facing probably a long federal sentence for exposing the George Bush emails. Remember how we found out that George Bush painted, you know, landscapes and pictures of his dog and all that?
Right.
And there was all sort of other, you know, political dirt that this guy unearthed. He was a famous, anyway, somebody modeling themselves after the hacker who called himself Guccifer is taking credit for this attack in the same way.
But is this a Russian, American? We don't know.
Who knows? I guess we'll
find
out.
Where did this Russian hacker story come from?
Well, this is interesting. So when you are a security research firm, one of the things that you look at in a breach like this, and there was a breach that happened, is what kind of tools they were using, what IP address, internet protocol addresses, what the numerical address of the computers were from which they carried out the attack. All of these things pointed them to, well, must have been the Russians, but it's also possible that one technically skilled and you know, bad person used those same tools.
To make it look like it was Russian.
Yeah. And I mean, if I didn't do it, but if I did, I'd want to make it look like the Russians or the North Koreans or the whatevers to deflect from myself until I had a moment to boast. And in this way, hackers and mass murderers are not unlike each other. They both crave attention, and they'll go to any means to get it.
Finally, in the boring but important category, a significant win for the net neutrality folks this week in the federal court system. What does it mean now? Basically, this decision said that the internet is a utility, like your phone.
Yeah. So there was actually a very funny Stephen Colbert thing that's going viral where he is in a roller coaster with an important figure in net neutrality to make the discussion of net neutrality more exciting. But what this boils down to is the FCC is looking at access to fast internet as the same kind of utility that landline phones were when I was a kid growing up way back in the 70s. And because of this, because it's such an essential tool for our lives, that individual cable companies, you know, the Time Warners, the Comcasts, the whoever's, shouldn't be able to throttle that connection. In other words, to decide for their business intents, for the benefit of their business, that they can turn it into a 1993 dial-up connection if you're connecting to something that isn't in their business interests. So the idea that the FCC is underscoring is that we all have a right to big, fat connections to the internet because that's the American way.
And the court supported that. The federal appeals court.
The court supports that. And the cable companies are saying that not only was that decision bad for their business, but it's bad for business in general, for even their competitors and for all of the other companies that rely on them, for the entertainment companies here in Hollywood who might be inclined to pay a kind of, you could call it a bribe. You know, they might be paying the cable companies for preferred speed. So there's some very hot and heavy arguments on both sides. But
for now, it's going to remain as it is.
Yes. So net neutrality hasn't been taken away from us, but it is still under threat. And it still
remains.
Because
there will be appeals and it might get to the Supreme Court.
Yes, that's exactly right. And these big and powerful companies that control our access to the internet want to make money off of that, and they don't want that right to be hindered in any way.
Ah, America.
God bless them.
Chevy Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And we want to hear from you. Do the social media companies have any culpability when criminals use them to plan or document their crimes? Let us know. Where else? On our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, science writer Mary Roach has a new book out about science and the military.
So I would approach these sort of intimidating special operations guys to chat about diarrhea.
The human body at war, next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In a book about military science, you may be surprised to find passages like the following.
I'm interested in diarrhea as a threat to national security.
Or,
on top of its other charms, the maggot breathes through its ass.
Or,
if you don't have a pair of cadaver shoes, you're not doing enough research.
You'd be surprised until you realize that this book on military science is also a Mary Roach book. She's the science writer behind books such as Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and Stiff, The Curious Life of Human Cadavers. Mary Roach's new book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War, and she joins us now via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, what are cadaver shoes?
Cadaver shoes are the shoes that a surgeon wears when he's doing any kind of cadaver work, and once you've worn them into the cadaver lab, they absorb a certain amount of smell and drip and mess, and you're not going to wear them anywhere else but the cadaver lab.
Okay. Why did you choose to look at war? You've written about the digestive tract. You've written about sex, dead bodies, as we said. What was it about war?
Well, it's a book that's most similar. I mean, if you look back at the books that I've written, Packing for Mars looked at the human organism physically and emotionally in the extreme scenario of space, trying to live in this environment for which you have not evolved and you have no coping skills and your body can't make sense of it. It's that sort of book, the human body in extreme physical circumstances and emotional. And in this case, what science brings to bear on that and trying to mitigate it, make it a little less god-awful. And it's something I got interested in reporting in India on a very hot chili pepper that the military had kind of weaponized. And I was at the science labs of the Indian Defense Ministry, and there was all kinds of interesting stuff going on, and it seemed sort of broachable, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There was leech repellent. Yeah, they were doing a leech repellent. They were working on just a variety of things that I don't normally associate with military science. Of course, you know, like most people, I think of bombs and weapons and strategy, which doesn't appeal to me as a topic. I'm not a technology writer. The human body is more my bag. So I was interested more in the human, the physiology of it.
Well, speaking of roachable, you like to approach topics that a lot of us are squeamish about. And let's dive right in and talk about penises and reconstructive penis surgery. IED attacks in Afghanistan and Iraq, they destroy sometimes the lower regions. In fact, quite a few veterans are suffering from penis injuries. And we don't hear a lot about that. First of all, why don't we hear a lot about that? We just don't want to talk about that?
Maybe a little bit that, but more for a long time, if you stepped on an explosive device that was large enough to not just affect your lower leg, but your pelvic region, you weren't likely to survive. But combat medical care, casualty care has become much better at keeping people alive and stabilizing them and evacuating them. So more men are, mostly men here we're talking about, are surviving to need reconstructive work because before they wouldn't have survived such an injury. So it's a good thing that they're surviving, but now it's keeping the urological surgeons busy over at Walter Reed.
The science you describe is pretty amazing. Tell us about some of the advances. In particular, you describe building a penis using tissue from the mouth.
Yeah, this was specifically the urethra, which is the tube that you urinate through. This particular soldier had damage to the urethra, and so they were replacing a stretch of it. The one way that in the past, they've done is taken a layer of skin from underneath the forearm where there's no hair. You don't want hair because if you've got urine contains minerals that can build up on a hair, and you get these little sort of stones that develop that can be problematic. So what they're using now, and what I observed when I was there, they're taking a rectangle of the inside of the cheek. Not only is it hairless, but it is built for withstanding moisture. It's built to be wet all the time. So somebody, and I don't know exactly who, came up with this idea of taking a rectangle from the inside of a patient's cheek and then rolling it up to form a tube and stitching it in place, and it works quite well.
And this is important because these are young men, by and large, and they want to have families.
Yes, that's right. And they want to be able to have sex. And that's something that, you know, the military is sometimes not all that comfortable with coming out and saying, yes, it's important to spend money on having intimacy therapy, counselors who can say, you know, not just for somebody who has damage to their genitals, but someone who's, say, missing both hands and part of a leg. Well, what kind of sexual positions work and what's suggested? I mean, there are techniques and there are ways to make that doable that aren't necessarily common sense that are going to the soldier is not necessarily, the veteran is not going to intuit. So there needs to be therapists who dedicated specifically to that work. But it's tough because there's a tremendous competition for funding dollars. The rates of limb amputation are far higher. I think it's something like 300 euro genital injuries to 18,000 amputations. So it's that as well.
The military spends a lot of money on trying to come up with solutions to illnesses and to problems that are experienced by people who live in very hot places normally or developing countries, so places where there isn't adequate sanitation or places where it's very hot. And it seems that a lot of our conflicts take place there. They're not taking place in Europe, for example. So what are some of the issues that the military is looking at when it comes to soldiers in the field? What are some of the biggest problems?
You mentioned heat and heat stroke, heat injury, and there's a whole spectrum, the most extreme of which is heat stroke, which can be fatal. Research is being done in that area. I was at USIS, the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences, and there's this program, Consortium for Health and Military Performance, and they have a cook box, as they call it, where they can simulate the environment in, say, summertime in Afghanistan in the middle of the day. And they've got a treadmill in there, and they can put you, you know, in on an incline with body armor, with a kind of load that you would carry at. They had a couple of Army Ranger instructors in there who are subjects. They were looking at differences. There's a lot of individual differences in whether you can acclimate to heat and perform or whether it just flattens you. And they were trying to figure out, is there a blood marker or some genetic difference? Is there some way to identify people who just don't cope with it and who are at risk of heat stroke? And can those people, then those people could be kept out of these extreme scenarios. So that's what they were working on. And it was, I was in there just because I wanted to be able to interview these guys, and it kind of an eye opener to be, you know, in that kind of heat on an incline, on a treadmill. They put a backpack on me, which was about a third as heavy as what an actual infantry person would be carrying. And I lasted 7 minutes. And they took it out because they were taking my core temperature through a rectal probe, and I was getting into like the danger zone, and I'd been on the treadmill for a while, and when they put on the pack, they're like, yeah, let's take that off.
But what do they do in the field, like in a place like Afghanistan or Iraq, where they're wearing a lot of equipment and a lot of body armor? They're carrying the big pack.
Yeah, a lot of attention is paid to proper hydration. So whoever is the head of the unit is making sure people are, because you know when you're hydrating, you're providing more, you know, fluid for the body to work with. And there are things like, you know, sweat prediction formulas where you can program in the temperature, how much they're going to be carrying, how fast they're going to be walking, and that will tell you how much water you need to bring, you know, in order to keep people hydrated so they can sweat to keep themselves cool. But it's the kind of thing where, you know, when the practicalities and day-to-day existence, day-to-day realities often don't match up with, you know, the planned activity. And so it's a little hard to be super scientific about it.
One of the biggest problems in the field is diarrhea. And that sounds like something we don't really want to talk about. But you actually confront it head on, and you find that the people, the members of the military you spoke with, were eager to talk about it because it's something that was quite common.
It is quite common in Iraq. Around, I think it was 2003 or 4, 77% of deployed personnel had diarrhea. 40% had it badly enough that they sought medical treatment, and 32% had been in a scenario where they couldn't make it to a bathroom in time. And the rates are twice as high among special operations teams, in other words, Navy SEALs and people who are out eating in villages with locals, interacting with locals, getting information, doing what they're doing. They're eating food that may not have been refrigerated, a lot of flies, water that's not safe to drink. So they're coming down with pretty extreme stuff. And you can imagine if you were on a mission to clear a compound or whatever it is, whatever critical classified mission you're on, you can't stop. If you're going to have to soil your pants, you soil your pants. And so I had some interesting conversations, all of them over dinner, because that's when the special operations guys would come out of their restricted zone and have meals. So I would approach these sort of intimidating special operations guys to chat about diarrhea. But they were, and I'd say, you know, it sounds like a silly topic. And this one guy was like, it's not. You're welcome to sit down.
This is a serious illness. This kills 2 million people a year, diarrhea.
Yeah, in developing nations mostly, and a lot of it among children. And the Navy is working with the Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and some other partners to actually come up with a vaccine that would be great, you know, and that would be not just for military, but anybody.
And how many of these military scientific experiments or advances actually end up helping the broader world?
A lot of, I mean, in the medical sphere, you know, most of them and most of the things, you know, whether it's a better tourniquet or figuring out that, you know, the needle decompression, you know, if you've got a collapsed lung, you need to relieve the pressure in the lung. One of the things the Morgan Dover figured out from a program called Feedback in the Field was that some of these buffer soldiers, I mean, who are there's a lot of weightlifting and bodybuilding that goes on as a sort of pastime. The needles, in fact, couldn't clear the muscles to get to the point where they were relieving the built-up air. When that came to light, that's something that in the emergency medical community, anybody could use that information. And now there are longer needles available. So sometimes it's just small things that make a big difference.
Mary, at the end of the day, this is about improving our capacity to fight our enemies on the battlefield, i.e. to kill people. Your book has a lot of funny moments in it. Did you have any trouble squaring that?
No, I mentioned that in the book, that it is, you know, that is something I'm aware of, that ultimately, you know, the people who make the policy and the strategy and you know, like throughout history, one of the goals in keeping people alive is to win the war, you know, to not have attrition, to not lose half of your fighting soldiers. But because I spent so much time with the people who are focused on the solution, and the immediate effect is that someone who's in that situation survives. You know, ultimately, the policy intent is not ideal, but I felt better to, you know, make the situation more tolerable and survivable, even if the ultimate intent to perhaps some general somewhere is to keep, you know, keep winning the war.
What was the funniest thing that you encountered doing research in this?
You know, there'd be these moments. Sometimes the humor just came from my utter cluelessness. I am an outsider, a pogue, I guess is the word that they use in the military for people like me. I was at it was like a tactical scenario with military audiologists, and as part of it, they were shooting at M16s, and so they were showing, it was sort of a demonstration, and I've never shot a gun, and this guy who's a special operations guy hands me this M16, and you know, I've seen how you put the magazine in, because I've seen movies, I've seen Bruce Willis do it, so I kind of go to like slap it in with the heel of my hand, like I know what I'm doing, and he very gently says, "Other way, so the bullets are facing forward." So just my own, just a clueless clown bumbling through the military.
So. Is that a Dr. Strangelove-esque?
Yeah, very, very much so.
Mary Roach, her new book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Thanks, Mary.
Thanks so much.
And coming up on this program, it's been 50 years since the Beach Boys released Pet Sounds. We investigate the mystery of the goats on the album cover. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 50 years ago, the Beach Boys released Pet Sounds, a collection of groundbreaking songs that redefined pop music for an entire generation. Since then, critics and fans have analyzed every single aspect of the album's 13 songs. But the album's genius was hardly represented by its cover. That's just a hokey, semi-staged-looking snapshot of the band standing at a petting zoo, feeding goats. How is it that one of the greatest pop albums of all time also has one of the dumbest covers? Producer Peter Gilstrap spoke with the members of the Beach Boys about their remembrances of the photo shoot.
One, two, three, four.
The goats awake before dawn. It's Thursday, February 10th, 1966. The air is cool and still over San Diego, and the sky is cloudy. In Los Angeles, 150 miles to the north, the Beach Boys arise and prepare for a journey. For on this day, the greatest band in America will meet seven goats in a petting zoo. It's everything. It's nothing. It's a moment in history. Brian Wilson.
I don't remember who thought of going to the zoo, but when we got there, we got some apples and we cut them in little pieces. We fed them to the goats, and they took a few pictures, and we decided to put that as our cover for Pet Sounds. We all looked so good, you know, we were so young and happy and smiling and great, you know.
He's right. In February of 1966, they were still young and happy and smiling and great. We know what happened to the Beach Boys. But what happened to those goats?
Who would know? Peter, who would know?
Somebody knows. But before we get there, let's stay in that Thursday in 1966.
Yeah, I remember I drove my new yellow XKE convertible down to the chute. How about that?
Beach Boy Mike Love had a new car.
Driving down Highway 1, because you take the coast route if you know what you're doing. You don't go up down the 5. You would take the beach route, right? So, yeah, we'd cruise by Trestles and Swami's and all the good places and then went to the zoo.
But for guitarist Al Jardine, that day in the petting zoo still holds dark memories, specifically of a large white goat that Jardine will be forever feeding on the album's cover.
I hated that sucker. That kept getting in my face. It took us all the way to the San Diego Zoo, not the L.A. Zoo. To this day, I can't even believe it. But at that time, we were just, you know, young and naive and thought, well, if that's what they want us to do, we'll do it. And of course, when they heard the title Pet Sounds, they thought we needed to go to a zoo and take a picture with a bunch of animals. But they may not have heard the material to realize that we were really referring to Brian's two dogs, Louie and Banana.
Hey, Chuck, is it possible we can bring a horse in here without, if we don't screw anything up?
I beg your pardon?
No, the horse was not possible.
So we put my dogs, Banana and Louie, my Beagle and my Weimar, on the train at the end of the thing. We put them barking right at the end. And a few minutes later, Mike goes, why don't we call this Pet Sounds, you know, because of the dog?
And so they did. People loved the name. Not everybody loved the cover.
McCartney literally said, Mike, I think you really ought to take more care with your album covers. Because what was Pet Sounds? It was a big white goat's butt on it. It was taken to San Diego Petting Zoo. I don't think we were as fixated or focused on the covers as we could have been. We were just focused on the music.
The core of that focus was Brian, who said at the time he wanted to create, quote, the greatest rock album ever made. And by many accounts he did. Thanks, perhaps, to another unusual connection to goats.
The goat is one of the 12 Chinese zodiac animals. It represents introversion, creativity, shyness, and being a perfectionist.
Really?
Does that sound like you?
Well, perfectionist, the other parts didn't. A perfectionist, my dad, taught me how to be a perfectionist. He said, when you mow the lawn, mow it twice, you know? So that stuck in my mind when I did Pet Sounds. I said to myself, I'm going to mow the lawn twice with this album. It's the music that counts. The cover was beautiful, though. It was beautiful. Can't explain the mood. We were all just like young kids feeding goats apples, you know?
Which brings us back to the mystery of the goats on the album's cover. San Diego Zoo public relations representative Christine Simmons provided the answer in a brief note. Thank you for your inquiry. I regret that the goats in the photo have all passed away. And as this is not a breeding group, they did not produce offspring. While there may still be Hemingway cats, there are no Pet Sounds goats. These simple, cloven beasts, petted by countless tiny hands of 1960s children, lived out their years and died. But they are not forgotten. As the humble goat once stood by at the birth of Jesus himself, these goats will be forever linked to the birth of Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys' masterpiece, Pet Sounds. For Press Play, I'm Peter Gilstrap in Los Angeles.
I don't even know what to say about that piece. Jilly Myers, hilarious.
You know, one thing I need to quibble here.
Yeah.
There's no goat sounds in that piece.
No goat sounds. What?
That was not planned. And that is not a goat sound, is it?
It's a cow goat. It's a cow.
Matt Holzman just piped through to tell us it was a cow.
Just looking at looking at the picture of pet sounds, these goats look a little menacing.
They're surly.
They're on their hind legs.
Oh, there's actually a bar called The Surly Goat in West Hollywood. It's a good beer bar. I wonder if it's based on pet sounds. Okay, enough with the cow noises. Let's talk about something serious now. We did talk about gun violence on the show today. Mm-hmm. It's been on a lot of people's minds this week. And Leo called in. He finds it mystifying that there's so much debate over what the Second Amendment means. Here's what he had to say.
It announces its intent within the language of the amendment itself. It doesn't require parsing and historical analysis to understand a sentence which tells you it applies to situations where there's a militia involved and doesn't apply to situations where there is no militia involved.
So Nate Amick wrote on Facebook, and he has a solution to all the confusion. He says, just give everybody a musket and call it a day. We can call them protection rifles, the more noble cousin of the assault rifle. But Daniel Burris wanted to quibble with the statistics about gun deaths in America that we talked about. He says that lumping in suicides with other gun deaths is not fair, and it is intellectually dishonest. If you eliminate that number, then there are more people who die from car wrecks than from gunshot wounds in America.
Still a gun death, if a suicide, by gun.
That is factually correct.
Okay. Just to be clear about that. Thank you, Julie Myers, and we'd love to hear from you at KCW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.